We live in an age of empire and resistance, a shifting geography of global power. The military, political, and financial support of one country, the United States, above all others, has allowed a small country, Israel, to commit genocide in Gaza, to the horror of the vast majority of people worldwide. The US military, its corporations, its digital giants, its banks, and its culture continue to dominate globally. Yet at the same time, US-led imperialism has never felt more fractured and resisted. The heavily resourced US Army has been forced out of Afghanistan and was recently expelled from Niger. Nations such as Nicaragua and South Africa are taking powerful former colonial countries to court. Other international institutions, long seen as vehicles for exporting or enforcing US-led neoliberalism, such as the World Trade Organization, have seemingly run out of steam. The US is also increasingly isolated globally. Brazil, China, India, Russia, and other nations are directly challenging its hegemony. And the US's dysfunctional democracy is less and less cited as a model by other countries. There's a growing popular sense that the post-Cold War neoliberal globalized order is in crisis. Is US hegemony really fading? Does any other nation, including China, pose any real challenge to US power, let alone offer a political or economic alternative? Has the heralded hope of a BRICS bloc collapsed amid its own contradictions? What would it take to build a more equitable and just new international political and economic order? Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. In this episode, to properly examine where geopolitical or geoeconomic power lies today and how it is being exercised and how that might be changing, TNI's Nick Buxton speaks to Adam Tooze and Weldon Bellow. Adam Tooze holds the Shelby Cullum Davis Chair of History at Columbia University and serves as Director of the European Institute. In 2019, Foreign Policy magazine named him one of the top global thinkers of the decade. Weldon Bellow is a TNI associate, an author of more than 20 books, a human rights and peace campaigner, academic, environmentalist, and journalist who has made a major contribution to the international case against corporate-driven globalization. Nick began by asking Adam to assess the current moment. Are we still in a unipolar world, or have things shifted?
I'm quite fundamentally convinced, I think, that we're already in a multipolar world. I think it's anachronistic to cling to a different view. I think we exited the unipolar moment in the 2010s. And this doesn't mean that there aren't still huge areas, huge domains of US power and US predominance even. The three obvious ones are certain sorts of military power. So not all by any means, but certain key areas, global finance and certain areas of high tech. I mean, these are three areas where the United States, I think, still can command absolute predominance. But in a more general sense, we've seen the fragmenting of American power, its delegitimization, the soft tissue, if you like, of American hegemony in its two classic moments in the aftermath of World War II and in the unipolar moment has attrited very considerably. And the ability of American elites to articulate the different dimensions of power is really threadbare at this point. And this doesn't preclude, you know, tub-thumping efforts at the reassertion of American dominance. I think this Trump 2 is going to look very different from Trump 1 in that respect. It doesn't preclude the more kind of nostalgic Atlanticist version of a similar agenda, which is what we saw with Biden and Blinken and Sullivan. But they are pushing against the tide of dramatic movements, which are ultimately rooted, to my mind, in I'm not a monocausal kind of person analytically, but if you did want to just nominate one driver, it would be the scale of global economic development, which has just created proliferating centers of competence and power above critical thresholds, which means that a whole variety of actors can now engage in various types of power politics, technological competence that they never were previously able to. In the most dramatic instance is China. But you can multiply that, right? The hugely increased competence of an Indonesia, a Turkey, United Arab Emirates, or Brazil, are just passing certain thresholds that we didn't see in the first post-colonial moment and constitute a new kind of polycentric order.
And how do you see it, Walden? Do you think we are in a polycentric order?
First of all, I really feel very honored to be paired with Professor Toombs, one of the most prominent economic historians today. Now, to the question, I know the media has made much lately of Trump's wanting to make Canada the 51st state, taking over Greenland and the Panama Canal, and renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. However, I don't think that Trump's project is best conceived as a reassertion of U.S. power globally. Now, if there's a project that might be regarded as a reassertion of U.S. global power, that was Biden's. Biden and Kamala Harris' project was basically the reinvigoration of liberal internationalism, which was essentially one of making the world safe for American capital through the projection of U.S. military and political power and free trade. That project, which was essentially the post-Pearl Harbor paradigm of the United States, had been damaged during Trump's first term in office. And Biden set out to repair the fraying alliances that Trump had instigated. Let me just say here that only in retrospect can one appreciate how radically the isolationist, anti-globalist, and protectionist foreign policy of the first Trump administration broke with liberal internationalism. Trump, among other things, tore up the neoliberal Trans-Pacific Partnership with both Democrats and Republicans champion, considered NATO commitments a burden and threatened to leave the alliance, demanded that Japan and Korea pay more for keeping U.S. troops and bases in their countries or face withdrawal of the U.S. military umbrella, trampled on the rules of the World Trade Organization, ignored the IMF and the World Bank and the U.S.-dominated global multilateral order, negotiated the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan with the Taliban, whom he wanted to invite to Camp David, and broke the West's united front against North Korea by stepping across the DMZ to pat Kim Jong-un on the back, and I believe that was June 2019. Now, looking at this record, one can understand the deep hostility towards Trump, not only of the Democratic Party establishment, that believes in the essential role of multilateralism and alliances in promoting U.S. hegemony, but also the neoconservative establishment represented by Dick Cheney, who prefers more unilateral methods to advance the same hegemonic project. And if I may just add a few more things, what do I think is a Trump project? Trump is unpredictability personified, but I think his instincts are basically isolationist and inward-looking. And one must not underestimate his playing to the significant part of his base, that is isolationist, a section that some analysts say is represented by J.D. Vance. His project, I might say, is one that might be labeled defensive imperialism as opposed to the expansive imperialism of the liberal internationalist project. It is rebuilding what he and his MAGA outfit considered a damaged core of the empire by putting up a wall against imports, against non-white migrants, and bringing back prodigal American capital or reshoring via raising tariffs. I agree with Viktor Orban, who is a close friend of Trump, that Trump wants to focus on fortifying the North American core of the empire. Though I would add that he considers South America's falling within the U.S. sphere of influence. His comments on Canada, Greenland, the Panama Canal, and the Gulf of Mexico might reflect this refocusing of priorities on the Americas. The U.S. posture in most other areas is, from this perspective, negotiable. And Trump certainly does not believe in the neoliberal international principle that compromising with or appeasing authoritarianism in one part of the world, like Ukraine, would be harmful to U.S. interests in other parts of the world. And yes, I definitely agree with Adam that we have been on the way to a multipolar world for quite some time now, and that the unilateral moment really did not extend beyond 2010.
Thanks, Walden. Let's come back to Adam about to respond to Walden. I think we can go into Trump a little bit later as well. Also to look at some of the underlying causes. You mentioned there that just the rise of economic competence of others, but having also read your books, there's also been some kind of key moments which has really shaped where we are right now in terms of the US response. So what do you see as the kind of underlying causes beyond the kind of rise of the economic competence of certain countries that has led to this more multipolar, polycentric moment?
I think I would add to what Walden, his description of the shock of the first Trump administration is very comprehensive and I think very compelling. But I guess I would argue that I see that fraying beginning earlier. You could go back to the unilateralism of the Bush administration, 2003, certainly on the transatlantic axis, that caused considerable ructions. And I think in terms of dynamizing the multipolar momentum, both in Beijing and in Moscow, that was a crucial moment. You can even argue the Yugoslav intervention, the Serbian intervention in the late 90s were important. But the opportunity, I think, really presents itself and the challenge presents itself with the 2008 financial crisis. And I think if we're looking at the, you know, the origins of Beijing's increasing determination to chart its own course, it doesn't start with Xi in 2012. It starts in 2008-9 with the realization that the United States is a kind of wobbly and unreliable anchor and an increasingly assertive position by Beijing. And then reactions within the Obama administration to that. I think I actually see a kind of a non-linear move here. With I completely agree with Walden that the Biden, Blinken, Sullivan moment is this sort of dramatic reassertion of liberal internationalism, really. But then what epoch does it most clearly relate to? And I don't see it as being the Obama epoch. And I think in retrospect, the Obama period looks like a relatively, I hate to say this, but like a relatively realistic adaptation of American power to change circumstances. Now, of course, they're still fighting wars of choice, the drone wars and so on. But nevertheless, I see in the Obama period, in retrospect, a more realistic reevaluation of the possibilities of American power than we saw either under Trump or Biden. So I think there's been a kind of atavistic turn with Trump and with Biden, two different versions of it, one more polite and Atlanticist than the other, but both of them, in a sense, this MAGA move, Make America Great Again, whereas I think the rather relatively cool assessment of America's essential functions with regard to financial stability, but otherwise quite limited purchase on the structure of world power under Obama was a moment. And inside the Obama administration, we already saw pushback against that because you have the Clinton, Kirk Campbell, Clinton, Hillary Clinton, that state groups maneuvering to reassert what will ultimately then reemerge as the Biden-Sullivan agenda. So I think, to me, I would start this story of the fraying of the 1990s unilateral moment a little earlier than Trump 16. I would see it in the period after 08. And that's, I think, because what that points to is the moment really at a base level at which it becomes apparent to the American leadership that the story of globalization, which is so key to the self-confident promotion of American power from the 90s onwards, could potentially turn against them in different ways. And we saw it in two crucial respects. One is Russia, because after all, Putin's Munich Security Conference speech comes just before 08, and then there's the Russian intervention in Georgia in 08. And then on the other hand, there is quite clearly a move in Beijing to reevaluate the terms. And the Beijing's offer is the Sunnylands deal of a new model of great power relations, which it looks as though Washington might take up, but then essentially it disperses. Its only fruit really is the Paris Climate Agreement of 15, which I think is seen by Beijing as a kind of carry through from that moment. And then instead what we get is Trump. So then that would just be my, if you like, my preface to Walden's account of the first Trump administration.
So would you like to add anything and end on the underlying causes of this fracturing?
Yeah. Yes, definitely. I agree with Adam on that point. And the underlying causes, on my end, I would identify three major contributors to this moment. One was the flight of U.S. transnational capital to China in search of their cheap labor, though, came to, I believe, less than 5% of the cost of American labor. Now, this was a process that enjoyed the blessings of Washington from the Bush senior administration to the Obama administration. Now, some estimate that the resulting so-called China shock cost the U.S. some 2.4 million manufacturing jobs and destroyed the synergy between technological innovation and a dynamic manufacturing sector. Now, the second major contributor that I would point to was financial mismanagement, which made the financial sector the favored sector for investment, owing to the massive profits that could be made from speculation. And both the industrialization and financial were key factors in the stagnation of the income and living standards of at least 50% of the population of the United States, and of course, the sharp rise in inequality. Now, the third major factor that I think we should not underestimate was the overextension of U.S. military power in the Middle East under the Bush administration, which basically became a trap from which Washington found it very difficult to extricate itself and led to its loss of credibility even with allies. And here I would just like to play to underline the pivotal role that whether or not our views about what is the morality of his moves, that Osama bin Laden was the critical figure of the period, the first decade of the 21st century. In fact, I would even say that he is the only Napoleonic figure of that time. And basically, I would say that what he did was basically something that Che Guevara had wanted to do with his idea of putting the imperial power, trapping it on many fronts. Now, the obverse of the U.S. deindustrialization was the super industrialization of China, which made probably the fastest run in history from being a complete outsider to the global capital system, the very center of the system in the history of capitalism. And this was in a period of just about 30 years. Now, this involved not just rapid industrialization, swift technology acquisition, so that the country's scientific and technological base is now largely self-sustaining, if we are to believe the assessment of the economists. Now, of course, this process was not costless. A recent estimate showed that for the period 1960 to 2018, China suffered a negative value transfer or unequal exchange of some $19 trillion. Moreover, rapid growth triggered multiple crises, by the environmental crisis. But then these were crises of growth, not of decline, as in the United States, where deindustrialization, stagnant incomes, rising inequality, and constant war triggered social polarization that led to the triumph of extremist politics with Trump.
Yeah, really important points there. I'd go next to where you think this new moment, that both the U.S.-China relationship, but also the kind of geopolitical increased rivalry, this polycentrism, how that's going to shape capitalism. What do you think this moment is doing in terms of reshaping both neoliberalism or fundamentally shaping capitalism? Could I come to you on that, Adam, first?
Yeah, we are in an unprecedented situation. I want to double down on something that Walden said between his two comments. The extraordinary development that we've seen is from the insertion of China into Western value chains on Western terms, with China being basically mobilized as this huge urbanization of hundreds of millions of Chinese rural dwellers to the cities into Western controlled manufacturing supply chains, to a shift in the last 10 years to a situation in which China entirely dominates global manufacturing in practically every key area, or is at least a significant rival or major player alongside Western or other East Asian competitors it doesn't have parity in every area of the most high-tech end of chip manufacturing, but then no one has parity with the Taiwanese on that score, right? Not America doesn't either. But in every area, China is a competitor, and it now dominates global manufacturing to an extent that we haven't seen since the high period, really, of US dominance after World War II. And as was true then in the case of the US, this is to a very considerable extent dominated by Chinese domestic demand, because China is just a huge market, 1.4 billion increasingly affluent people who buy their own manufactured goods. And so those markets are not just dynamic, but they're also essentially trend-setting. And the area where we're seeing this most dramatically is in electric vehicles, where it's now clear that essentially the Chinese ecosystem, the market, the demand, the pace-setting consumer style, and the technology and the manufacturing capacity are all essentially China located. And global auto players like Toyota and VW, we can write off Detroit. It's also ran at this point, but the major East Asian and European competitors in the global auto business face a strategic choice as to whether or not they hang in the Chinese market or increasingly rely on various types of protectionism to shield their local markets against that Chinese competition. And it's worth focusing on auto because if you actually look at sophisticated, large-scale globalization of supply chains, the auto industry, it was once the hub of global capitalism in the age of Fordism, drifted out of sight in the 70s and 80s. But if you look at the statistics, it's unambiguously one of the key drivers of at least regional development of supply chains. And we're seeing here a historic shift of a type we've not seen before, with the shift in drive chains and the shift in the locus of innovation to China. And it's an internal Chinese development. Does this change capitalism? Not per se, right? Because capitalism is a constantly evolving, morphing system. It doesn't have a single unity. It's not centered on a single technology. But is it a major shift in one of the key areas of the global division of labor? It clearly is. If I may just expand on one other area, look at finance. What we've seen there since 2008 is really an increasing bipolarity, right? We have a US-dominated system centered around the dollar, in which once upon a time it was polycentric, with the Europeans and East Asian players being significant alongside Wall Street. That's largely evaporated since 2008. So we have a dollar system massively dominated by the key American players, the BlackRocks, the JP Morgans, which have a dominance in that sector we've not seen before. And then separate from that, within the envelope of the Chinese exchange rate and currency controls, a Chinese system, which again, given the scale of the Chinese market, has scale which compares to the JP Morgan's, in fact, is even larger in many cases, but is not part of the same system. Now, again, does this change capitalism? I don't think in principle it does. It changes its geographic scope. It changes its horizon of expectation with regard to globalization. But is the emergence of BlackRock and JP Morgan as these dominant players in some sense a basic shift? I would be skeptical about that. I think the nationalization tendency, the tendency towards protectionism, is a new and important development in its aggressive form. And again, it's a bipartisan thing in the United States. It's both the Democrats and the Republicans which are on board with this. Even under a Clinton administration, I don't think the TPP would have gone through in 2017 or 18. The Clinton team were quite explicit about the fact that from their point of view, as far as market extension was concerned, neoliberalism was over. They weren't going to push it. So I think there is this break in America's political economy. But does that fundamentally change capitalism? No, because clearly, America's capitalism developed in the 19th century under a massively protectionist system. There are many different ways in which this can manifest and develop. It changes the direction. It changes the bargaining power of different actors. It changes the points at which bargaining power can be applied and leverage can be applied. And in the form of the Chinese system, we are seeing something which doesn't neatly fit, I think, to my mind at least, within a sort of cookie-cutter definition of what capitalism is, because the role of the party and the role of state institutions is too powerful. Some folks will want to subsume that under a nation of state capitalism. I'll leave that to them. But in any case, we're seeing a diverse, a complex, polycentric model in which in key areas, big shifts are happening. In others, there's a kind of almost the consolidation of American power within the dollar system.
Yeah. Walden.
Yes, I find much to agree with Adam in what he just said. Let me add a few more things here. China, of course, has the last few years touted its model of political capitalism as the reason for the success of the country's development. And when Trump tore up the TPP and repudiated free trade, basically accelerated the process of abandoning the neoliberal model of market-driven corporate expansion with minimal state intervention and regulation. The Biden administration, as we know, took a giant step towards industrial policy with the passage of the, I believe it was called the Inflation Reduction Act, the Chips and Science Act, and the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act over the last few years. However, neoliberalism continues to be the ideology of the IMF and the World Bank. In many countries that have IMF and World Bank programs, like my own country, the Philippines, they continue to implement neoliberal policies because the Bretton Woods institutions have pushed them to legislate these policies and even institutionalize them in their constitutions. Nevertheless, the massive failure of neoliberal policies will inevitably create tremendous pressures to abandon these policies and force adoption of initiatives that will prioritize social welfare, re-regulation, and a leading role of the state. Now, the revolt against neoliberalism in 2019 in Chile, and I'm focusing on the Global South here, Chile, which was probably the most neoliberalized country in the Global South, is a trend that we will see more and more, though the transition in some countries may not be as dramatic. Now, in the post-neoliberal state, I believe that national economic goal setting will be the trend. Planning will again become legitimate. Technocratic decision making on such fundamental issues as the relative proportion of resources to be devoted to consumption and investment will be more salient. The greater role of the state in countries where authoritarian or fascist regimes come to power means that a whole host of economic privileges and incentives will be provided to the majority population while stripping minorities of access to them. And India here is a pace setter. In terms of relationships among governments, the era of globalization, which saw the free flow of capital and goods across national borders, guaranteed by a multilateral system promoting these movements, will give way to more bilateral relationships in trade, capital flows, aid, and migration, with the character of these relationships determined by whether countries are geopolitical rivals or whether they are racially or culturally compatible. I think that what Trump calls whole countries, quote unquote, meaning most of us in the Global South, will be marginalized from this web of bilateral relationships. Now, one must also factor in the fact that the institutional landscape of capitalism is changing. The Fordist corporation under managerial control is now only one of several incarnations of capital. As Melinda Cooper has shown, there has been a revival of dynastic capitalism or family-owned wealth transmitted intergenerationally through changes in inheritance laws and favorable tax treatment, with Trump being an example of the increasing importance of this phenomenon, along with the Koch brothers. And we have also witnessed the emergence of billionaires with the Napoleonic complex, eager to use their access to the state as well as the media and civil society for their personal goals, like Trump, Elon Musk, and Jeff Bezos. So I would just like to sum up that we have as key elements of the current global institutional landscape the return of the activist state, the re-regulation of the market, the return of dynastic capital, and the emergence of Napoleonic capitalism.
Thanks, Wharton. Adam, would you like to respond to some of this? And I guess I'd also like to pass out a little bit about the, and not just these dynastic, whether there's a kind of dynastic capitalism, but also the kind of role of big tech, which seems to be very much emerging as a force. And one of the essays in the State of Power was talking about how just still within these terms, even if China is the production and much of the firms, much of the capital is owned by the US, much of the profits are still going back to the US, very much still dominates, even while they might be producing more electric cars, is very much dominating the value chains of big tech. So it's still very much in a kind of hegemonic position in that sense. But just more generally, your response both to Walden and what is the role of big tech in this polycentric moment too?
If I might pick up on the question of neoliberalism, which may be a useful way of organizing our thinking here, I find it useful to just distinguish different dimensions of the phenomenon. One is the ideological one, the doctrine, which I think we can all agree has become very threadbare and has been quite fundamentally disrupted and abandoned in some cases quite flagrantly. So Jake Sullivan announcing the end of, you know, the neoliberal era and a new Washington consensus. But then you can also think about neoliberalism as a mode of governance, And what was really telling, for instance, about the Biden Inflation Reduction Act is how it actually worked. And the way it worked is essentially public-private partnership, right? This wasn't the Green New Deal. So this wasn't the Green New Deal model. It wasn't the old New Deal model. It was essentially a bunch of tax breaks for private players. And so much as this was a government scheme to promote green energy, the way it worked was essentially exactly in the manner that the World Bank or the IMF has been prescribing since the late 1980s. If you look at the most substantial interventions that have been undertaken, they run through central banks acting on repo markets and the balance sheets of financial actors, right? So this is a more activist state fueled by an ideology that is breaking with certain sorts of nostrums of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and yet is using the tools which are really quite familiar from that earlier era. We do not have the means of intervention in the West that both the Chinese and, say, other more power states like Russia, for instance, can deploy against oligarchic wealth. If you look at neoliberalism in a third way, it's a class project, right? It's a question of redistribution. It's a question of actually breaking the existing entrenched defensive structures of the working class and the institutions of the welfare state, such as they were, and projects of national development that have to be unearthed, torn out. And again, at that level, you'd have a hard time actually arguing that there's been any really fundamental change at all. In fact, you could think of the current moment as an amplification of the existing interest structure. Certainly, the reason why the Inflation Reduction Act passed in the United States is not some sort of assertion of working class power, but essentially just a reworking of the monopoly interest groups or oligopolistic interest groups within the energy sector. And it turns out that you can find a bunch of green energy interests that will also like subsidy from the American state to make their shareholders rich and pursue projects which are environmentally transformative in various ways, but are still as very much about profit as anything before, right? So this will be the next era, Duke Energy, players like this in the American system. Nothing changes there. And I think at the level of another level of neoliberalism, which comes to your point about big tech, if we think of neoliberalism as a cultural project, as an idea of, as it were, the subjectification of human beings, not as citizens or as members of social networks, but as market actors, then after all, the platform economies of the current moment are the most radical instantiation of precisely that kind of model, right? The self-branding, the self-fashioning, the self-promotion of literally tens of millions now of folks that aspire to be influencers, both in the Chinese social media system, which is there certainly are ways in which American platform economies are special, but you don't have to spend very long in China to realize that society is actually much more profoundly organized around platform structures than anywhere in the West. You simply can't live in China without being on the WeChat system. You can't buy anything. You can't take a taxi. You can't go to a grocery store. It's a much more deeply integrated system, and it's one that at the level of individual subjectification drives the process of marketization and self-marketization increasingly aggressively. We could talk about the impacts of those platform economies of politics, but at the deeper level, they enroll us as new types of market actors in profoundly pervasive ways, which are truly global in their scope, that they reach the Philippines and Indonesia as much as they do China and large parts of Africa, anywhere where you can attach a smartphone to a cellular network, right? Essentially, you are part of that system. It's even post-literate in many parts of the world, because you don't need to have the deep infrastructure of public telephones, palatine systems, and you don't need to have fully literate populations for these systems to actually operate. And the final dimension of neoliberalism we could talk about is American power, right? It wasn't called the Washington Consensus for nothing. It was centered on a certain conception of American power, and that is fraying, fragile, we're talking about it. So I see a kind of wraparound in which the ideology and the element of American power is quite fragile, but most of the elements in between, which have to do with this pervasive, much more pervasive paradigm of governance, of class power, of subjectification, are still alive and well, in some ways, moving in at a speed, at a pace, in a pervasiveness, and on a global scale, which fulfills the true fantasies of the 70s and 80s prophets of market liberalization. There were elements of that which had to do with capital account liberalization and the details of privatization. But in a broader sense, do we now live globally in societies which are closer to the Milton Friedman ideal of market-driven interaction? Of course we do. And on the scale of billions of people.
Walden, do you want to come back on or respond to any of that?
I think the dimensions that were articulated by Adam, the dimensions of neoliberalism, I think that's very helpful in terms of being able to assess where it's at this point. As he has said, as an economic cultural phenomenon that integrates people into this market-driven global system, if you look at it at that level, certainly, I would certainly agree with but in terms of policies, in terms of ideology, in terms of specific things like capital account liberalization, those, I think, have really fallen by the wayside. And as an ideology at this point in time, he definitely is right that it's a very threadbare sort of thing.
A lot of our work has been very much focused on corporate power. Corporate power is behind a lot of injustices, whether it's the impunity, lack of accountability, whether it's human rights abuses, whether it's just the concentration of power and the elites and not going to workers and so on. So it's been very much central to our work. But of course, at this moment, we have the return of the nation state, China the most successful, of course, being very much driving a much more state-led moment. So I was just wondering my question was, when we look at geopolitics, which very much looks at this from the picture of nation states, is that still the best frame to do it? There was a shift towards understanding this much as transnational corporations being the kind of key actors on the global stage. But is that shifting right now with the geopolitical?
I think we're in a testing phase. We've certainly left behind the era in which one could straightforwardly and simply argue, I think, that the ultimate power were the big global corporate players. We've left behind the era in which it was just taken for granted that the US Treasury Secretary would be a former CEO of Goldman Sachs, which was a so deeply entrenched an idea that Tim Geithner was mistaken for a former employee of Goldman Sachs, whereas in fact he was a lifelong civil servant who just happened to be a protege of Rubin in the 90s, who was a former CEO of Goldman Sachs. The scenario in which you have a Hank Paulson, a former CEO of Goldman Sachs, appointed by the Bush administration in the early 2000s to run the strategic dialogue with China over economic relations, is unthinkable now, right? And so there has been quite a deep shift. But I think it's really a testing. My own understanding of political economy, both in the domestic and the international realm, is of a kind of a struggle, of a contestation. It has a variable geometry. There are clearly massive corporate powers that at all sorts of levels exercise influence and structure, both the details of regulation and the conditions of possibility of government action and the realm of what is discursively thinkable and not. But they stand opposite and sometimes in very close cooperation with and sometimes in antagonism with other key players, and state power and the security apparatus, a key element of this. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. We have a test case in front of us. It's an unconventional corporate power, but it's Elon Musk and his relationship with China. So there are two like key bellwethers of America's relationship with China. One is Apple and the other one is Tesla and Musk. And it will be very interesting to see how the specifics, and one really has to go into the detail of exactly how the interests of particular corporations are being either challenged or actually carefully sheltered and protected in the way, for instance, we know that Apple's interests were, despite the announcements of heavy tariffs by the first Trump administration on all trade with China. Apple, in the end, ended up with, after some highly successful lobbying, very significant carve-outs for all of the key elements of its supply chain. And as being at the time America's most valuable public company, the first one to break the $3 trillion threshold, this isn't something a White House easily does, is to attack the interests of an Apple, even if at some level its business model and its supply chain model goes deeply against American national security strategy at that moment. And it'll be very interesting to see how the Tesla thing plays out. My sense about this is that we're in a kind of broken play. We don't know how these interests are going to be articulated. And there are reverberating effects where a Huawei, for instance, singled out by the United States for an absolutely extraordinary campaign directed against a particular company by the American state apparatus. Of course, the consequence of that in part is that Huawei's position within the Chinese space shifts. And so whilst it loses global markets and is subject to this really surgical, it's a bit like drone warfare, these strike after strike, its freedom of maneuver and its scope for action within the Chinese economy, which is vast, and in various elements of the One Belt, One Road program, increases. So it's a very complex geometry, this. And I don't think we know yet how this is going to play out, would be my, I know it's a wait and see answer. I know it sounds a little open-ended, but I think that's the, to my mind, the only realistic account of the current moment.
And how do you see it, Walden? I think there's a daily experience where corporate power is still very dominant in most decisions that affect people's lives. And yet you also see places like Davos, which were seen, if you were saying where there's a locus of power, it would have been Davos 20 years ago. And now it seems to be a bit of a sideshow. But then in the global south, I wonder whether there's a different perspective on this, which, and especially one that's closer to China, both geographically and economically.
I would just like to add this idea of a period of contestation, a period of testing, like the whole thing about TikTok and how basically I believe Trump has said that Supreme Court hold off on TikTok, let me decide on that. And so there's all of this playing around, groping, filling out in terms of the relationship with the state and foreign transnational corporations, even in the United States. Perspective in the global south, my sense is the nation state is in fact likely to become even a more powerful actor relative to the market and the private sector. I believe with the realization that economic prosperity and advance will depend more and more on government actively supporting technological advance and preventing rival countries from getting advanced technology, with the thrust being to classify all sensitive technology as dual use and thus subject to export controls. Transnational corporations, I fully agree, will continue to be influential actors. But they will increasingly find themselves having to adapt to government policies like reshoring and transferring key parts of their value chain from arrived countries. And also they've become much more defensive owing to attacks from populist elites. And I guess one must remember that transnational corporations have been accused by Peter Navarro and others in MAGA as having betrayed the United States by moving to China. And I think that the kind of populist backlash against the TNCs is also very important in terms of assessing, you know, their relationship to the state at this point in time. Fully agree that we don't have the kind of Goldman Sachs phenomenon of Wall Street people just being appointed to head up the Treasury. So there is this testing period, but I would say that the nation state is in fact an even more powerful actor than the market and the private sector. And I think from the perspective of the Global South, definitely much more.
There's a very interesting point that Walden suggested there about the hostility of the MAGA crowd to various sorts of corporate power in the United States. And I think that needs to be taken quite seriously. And I also think it's quite general in its implications, which is that, and it goes to your point, Nick, about Davos, at some level, corporate power is aligned with the professional managerial class. And ultimately, who owns it and who generates the profits is one thing. But most very large corporations are held in quite diverse ways and are then run at one remove by way of funds like BlackRock or whatever, which themselves embody a kind of algo-based professional managerial approach to the governance of global capitalism. And at some level, those social groups are deeply enmeshed with a kind of structural liberalism, a cultural liberalism that is poisonous, toxic from the point of view of the MAGA crowd. This doesn't mean that the MAGA crowd doesn't like business. It just doesn't like that version of business, which is corporate, large-scale, dominated, as Jacob Diamond said, by lawyers and shrinks. Right? That kind of vision of how you run modern capitalism is not the ideal image of business, of money-making, that the MAGA crowd warms to and the populace in general warm to, who are quite addicted to a kind of a petty bourgeois model, right? The small scale, what some analysts in the US call the American gentry. It's the car dealership, the large construction company, the small scale retail chain, the person who has a bunch of Chick-fil-A franchises, who is easily in the top 1% of the American income and wealth distribution, is worth $10, $20, $30, $40 million, has a big mansion, a second home in Florida, and some sort of motor yacht, which they drive around in, right? But do not belong amongst the corporate titans that show up at places like Davos. And so within the Trump camp, in the end, after all, somebody from Wall Street has ended up in the Treasury position. But he's not a former CEO of an absolutely gigantic bank, right? The kind of paradigmatic big money person around Trump is private equity, hedge fund. And the advantage of those people is, A, they're wealthier, because you get much wealthier doing that than you do running a big bank. Jamie Dimon struggles to earn $1 billion over the course of his career. If you're working in PE or hedge funds, that's an annual salary in a good year for the best paid people. But it's above all, it's freebooting. It's easy come, it's easy go. You're working in a small shop with 200 to 200 to 300 people. So you can set your own culture, you can set your own style. And I think in understanding the way in which the relationship between populist politics and capitalism has morphed over time, it's crucial to dig into these cultural differences. And then spinning that out to the global scale, right? There are all of these complicated affinities between various types of patrimonial capitalism and, say, the BJP project in India, right, where you have a Modi-aligned group of oligarchs who represent a certain cultural style, represent a certain mode of doing business in India. And it's at that level that the affinity is deep. And it's at that level, all of a sudden, that relationship between the mass base of the BJP and globally relevant and globally listed corporations becomes thinkable. Right, because on the face of it, it would just seem not to go together. But if it comes in a certain shading, if it comes in with a certain cultural style, it works, which is why the Musk-Trump partnership is even thinkable in the current moment, right? Because it takes an Elon Musk version of billionairedom to establish this relationship. And we have in our analysis, I think, to be super sensitive to these kind of logics. Certain things will go, other things really won't go together in this time of testing. And it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not a single cultural mode. And one of the great fallacies of American liberalism in particular is to think that one size does fit all, right? The best law school, the best corporate job, connections in California and Hollywood and Silicon Valley. How could a candidate like that not be electable, right? There's a sort of mental failure on the part of the American liberal elite to fail to understand how, in fact, that specific combination of power, cultural privilege, economic privilege could, in fact, be profoundly distasteful to a solid majority of the American population.
Yeah, very interesting. It reminds me a bit also, we worked with Gabor Schiering, who looked at Hungary when and has been talking about the emergence of kind of this nationalist kind of forms of capital, yep. and how that interacted with the kind of more internationalist German-dominated capital, and how Orban kind of really thrived on creating these fractions of capital against each other.
I think that's precisely the kind of analytic which is more and more necessary. And we see this in China as well, right? The Jack Ma story being absolutely representative of this. But you see this in Thailand. You see this in Brazil. The logic of it, our mode of analysis has got to get sharper to really capture these fine differences.
And it relates to what Walden was saying also about this kind of dynastic forms of capital as well, because yeah. that's clearly, that somehow that's seen as, that somehow culturally that's more okay to have a kind of Musk than a diamond, because yeah. he's got a sort of like a similar sort of Trump vibe. I wanted, because we were running close to time, I want to shift a bit more to what this, well, I guess there's a few things I'd like to make sure we include in the conversation before we wrap up. One is the kind of future of the US-China relationship, and particularly this sense that alongside this kind of economic competition, we've also got increasing military rivalry. And yet US and China are very codependent in many ways. And then really what this means for, and this is really central to TNI, which has worked with social movements, particularly across the world and particularly in the global South, what does this mean for low and middle income countries?
Again, I find myself in very much in agreement with this, looking at having a more microscopic look at the different fractions of national capital. But going to the key question that you have, the US-China relationship, we have seen the US-China relationship transform from a partnership to rivalry in less than a decade. Throughout the last 10 years, we have seen the US take the lead in defining China as a rival, while China has consistently called for a return to what it calls normal relations with the United States. That is the partnership period between the late 80s and 2016. China has also disclaimed its intention of replacing the U.S. as the global hegemon and has not promoted an alternative multilateral system to the Bretton Woods system. The New Development Bank and contingency reserve arrangements of the BRICS system remain, I think, purposely underdeveloped. And though it has increased defense spending, China has not made any leaps in spending, with the U.S. consistently spending about 3 times as much as Beijing over the last few years. My sense is Trump is likely to continue the trade and technology war in China, but I'm much less certain that he will carry out the military containment that was accelerated by the Biden administration. Trump is a synonym for unpredictability, but I think there's a good chance that he will largely see the Asia-Pacific as being in China's quote-unquote, sphere of influence politically and economically, while maintaining the rhetoric of continued U.S. engagement with the region. Now, there is an expectation among analysts as well as bureaucratic elites that a hegemonic transition, that is a transition from one global hegemon to another, is inevitable. But with the U.S. likely to be hesitant under Trump, mainly because of realization of constraints, to assume the old role of global hegemon, and China unwilling to fill it, what we may see developing in the short and medium term instead might be a hegemonic vacuum, much like that in the interwar period in the 20th century, when Britain was too weak to perform the role of global hegemon, and the U.S. did not want to fill it. So let me just end there, and my comments there, that as a question, it's a question to Adam and to others. Are we, in fact, moving towards transition to another global hegemon, or are we really talking about a vacuum that is developing.
But before answering that, Warden, I was wondering if you could also answer this about what the implications of this, whether it's a hegemonic vacuum or whatever you choose to describe it, what this means for low and middle income countries. How should they navigate this process, particularly coming from the Philippines? How are they navigating and what are the kind of opportunities in this new world order and the challenges as you see it?
Okay, sure. I agree with Adam that we have entered an era of what he calls polycrisis, where the climate crisis, geopolitical rivalry, the North-South divide, and the democracy versus fascism conflict will intensify owing to the negative synergy they will derive from each other. Now, there is that enigmatic line Gramsci used to describe his era that I think is also appropriate for ours. And I quote, "The old world is dying and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters," end quote. I guess what he was trying to say was that you cannot have opportunity without crisis. Now, as I mentioned earlier, perhaps we should be looking not so much at a hegemonic transition, but the emergence of a hegemonic vacuum akin to, but not exactly the same as that which followed the First World War, when the weakened Western European states had ceased to have the capacity to restore their pre-war global hegemony, while the United States did not follow through on Wilson's push for Washington to assert hegemonic political and ideological leadership. Now, within such a vacuum or stalemate, the U.S.-China relationship would continue to be critical, but with neither actor able to decisively manage trends such as extreme weather events, growing protectionism, the decay of the multilateral system that the United States put in place during its apogee, the resurgence of progressive movements in Latin America, the rise of authoritarian states, the likely emergence of an alliance among them to displace a faltering liberal international order, increasingly uncontrolled tensions between radical Islamist regimes in the Middle East and Israel. Now, basically, I'm one of those that views the current crisis of U.S. hegemony as offering not so much anarchy but opportunity. Although there are risks and great dangers involved, a hegemonic stalemate or hegemonic vacuum, whatever you choose to call it, might open up the path to a world where power could be more decentralized, where there could be greater freedom of political and economic maneuver for smaller, traditionally less privileged actors from the global South, playing off the two superpowers against one another, and where a truly multilateral order could be constructed through cooperation rather than being imposed through either unilateral or liberal hegemony. So let me just sum up by saying that the crisis of U.S. hegemony may lead to an even deeper crisis, but it may also lead to opportunity for us. So taking off from Gramsci's word, we may be entering an age of monsters, but like Ulysses, we cannot avoid going through the dangerous passage between Scylla and Charybdis if we are to get to the promised safe harbor. Now, I wish I could be more concrete, but I just wanted to say that this could be the trends that we in the global South will have to grapple with.
Great. Thank you, Warden. Adam?
This is such a fundamental set of questions. It's almost as though we would need to do another round of this conversation, I think, to do it justice. I'm on the record as I find the Gramsci quote that Walden has cited unhelpful for thinking about the current moment, because it promises too much, right? We read it now against the backdrop of knowing what happens next, which is that this period of interregnum ends and is then superseded by the 1940s settlement with two orders, a Western and US dominated and on the hand, Soviet orientated bloc. And I don't think that's promised to us in the current conjunct. I don't think the 20th century is going to be a good model for thinking about the 21st century, any more than the 19th century was a good model for thinking about the 20th century. So I think the 20th century model of hegemony, which was essentially an American-centered one as far as the West was concerned, which has two high moments in the 40s and then in the 90s, was an epoch. And I think the future, for better and for worse, or maybe we should put it the other way around, for worse and very much the better, is going to be more complex and more polycentric. And that's the world that we're actually in and we're adjusting to. And that has many attractive features. Apart from anything else, it just realigns the balance of cultural, economic, technological weight with the distribution of humanity, right? Where we move out of the grotesque disproportion of those factors that dominated the 19th and early 20th centuries towards a much more balanced, much more at that level, rational allocation of resources. But it also comes with real risks. And I'm worried about war. I didn't think I would have to worry about war again. I'm a child of the European late Cold War, 70s, 80s, West Germany. I thought the prospect of nuclear annihilation was one that was shaping my childhood, but would be and youth, but would not be one that shaped my adulthood and my child's future and her children's future. But I'm afraid that is the world that we're back in. And the truly terrifying thing about the current moment is the deep, deep, powerful interests on the American side, and no doubt they're also deep and powerful on the Russian and the Chinese side as well, are increasingly committed to a nuclear arms race with a whole bunch of other things, space, hypersonic. It's not the old nuclear arms race, both in terms of the technologies and in terms of the fact that it's a three-player game. And that is unleashing on the American side a series of thought processes which are utterly staggering in their long-run implications, right? Because if you think from the American side that you might face a coalition of Russian and Chinese nuclear threats, then the level at which you have to act and the scale at which you have to act and the opening of the targets that you have to be able to consider is extraordinary. And we're already seeing American hawkish think tanks argue for the direct targeting, for instance, of Chinese urban areas as the way of maximizing the deterrent bang for buck in an increasingly unmanageable tripolar world. And we're just at the beginning of this. This competition is maybe 5 years old. So the horizon of the next decades, I think, is truly alarming, especially because in 2023, we already lived through the first war scare. If you were at all closely connected with military high-level policymaking in Washington, D.C. in early 2023, the signs of huge anxiety, borderline panic about the timeline which the Pentagon was pushing towards for war in the East Asian arena, which essentially the clocks were all setting to 2025, was palpable. And that's the first time this has happened since the end of the Cold War, since the mid-80s and Gorbachev's arrival on the scene. And it is an alarming and spectacular development, the scale of which we haven't yet fully reckoned with. Against that backdrop, one of the huge challenges, I think, for global progressive politics is that we have to engage with the peace question. This was core to global politics in the 70s and 80s in the West. It was hugely explosive. It was extremely difficult because it always opens you up to the allegation that you're basically a fifth column for external threats, the Soviet Union / China. And for decades, we could delegate peace to Goldman Sachs, right? Because as long as the Goldman Sachs CEO was running this strategic economic relationship between the China and the US, you knew that war was not on the agenda because too much money was going to be made. But one of the side effects of the reemergence of the nation state and core national security interests as the dominoes, the trump card in policy debate, is that progressive politics around the world now has an interest, to my mind, in arguing for peace as such, as the essential precondition for anything else good that we want. Now, this does not necessarily mean a surrender on every single other front, right? It doesn't mean turning a blind eye to the human rights abuses, which are flagrant, to the repression of freedom of speech in Hong Kong and so on. But it poses this question in a new way. And I think it's very challenging. It's very challenging for notably the Western left to articulate this position, but it's essential that we begin doing so, because otherwise we're going to end up finding ourselves enrolled in American power projects, which are essentially the anachronistic defense of America's Cold War era position in East Asia. And this is despite the fact that opinion polling, both in the United States amongst young people and in Europe, overwhelmingly already makes clear that there is simply no majority for instance, an ironclad commitment to Taiwan's independence against Chinese threats, right? There's no appetite on the part of the majority of the European population. And forgive me for speaking parochially about that group, but I'm sure it's true for the vast majority of the rest of humanity as well. for a a do or die confrontation over Taiwan. And so we need to embrace, and I mean that in the most comprehensive sense, the difficulty of these choices, because one should not kid oneself that these are simple matters, right? This is the classic terrain of progressive political dilemmas going all the way back to the era that Walton invoked, which is the period of the interwar period and the question of where one stands on appeasement, which is a profoundly difficult terrain to be on. I think in the meantime, this has to be coupled with various types of autonomist, Gaullist, non-aligned moves, right? This has got to be coupled with a strong assertion by progressive politics of independent interests for regions, collectivities, entities like the EU, ASEAN. I thought it was very telling how, for instance, the Indonesian G20 presidency, in the full flush of the hysteria in the West over the Ukraine war, nevertheless took this position of saying, we, speaking for the rest of humanity, insist that there are other items on the agenda, and we expect you, the United States, the Europeans, and China, to talk seriously about them, because this is actually the majority of humanity and its interest, and they are fundamental material issues that we need to discuss and go on discussing. I'm not touting now the Indonesian government as like an example of radical progressive politics in the current moment, but it tells you and it shows you the fact the G20 meeting did not disintegrate, that the business did continue, is an indication also of the leverage which major G20, G30, G40, G50 players in this polycentric system have. They count. It matters. You can actually get Washington's attention. You can also get Beijing and Moscow's attention in the current moment, because so much is in play, right? It's not just the corporate state relationship that's being tested. The entire power configuration is being tested in this moment. And progressive politics has a huge stake in this. And how this is worked at the level of trade policy, at the level of basic democratic rights, at the level of managing domestic power configurations and resisting some of these oligarchic combinations which are emerging in the national protectionist moment. But I think even more fundamentally, at the level of the question of peace. And I mean, as hard as that nut is, I think we have to take it seriously, because that's without that on the sort of line that the Pentagon, and for heaven's know, I had no insight into Chinese military decision making. I have no idea what the hawks on their side are doing. But in the US, we have a degree of insight into what's going on. And it is profoundly alarming how real the question of great power war with China has become, how quickly this has happened. And how concrete it now is, and how that is being used to leverage other policies and other moves, which are now becoming just almost like a kind of reflex in Washington. And it is a huge challenge for progressive politics, which I think we're only at the beginning, really, of measuring up, because for several decades under the sign of globalization, it wasn't an issue that we really had to deal with.
Thank you, Adam. I think, and Walden, perhaps you could conclude a bit about, which was the final question, was how do social movements respond to this moment globally? What should be the response of progressive movements at this time? What do we need to discover? What do we need to recover? Where do we need to advance?
Here, I fully agree that we probably need another session. But nevertheless, yes, the dangers of war, especially for those of us in East Asia, and the Philippines is right there. Over the last few years under Biden, really the containment of China and the provocative moves that he made with respect to ships transiting the Taiwan Straits, and the sort of way that this moves really opened up the Pentagon's or the military's basically unleashed them in terms of, at least in rhetoric. But as Adam said, this was not just in rhetoric. We had the head of one of the U.S. Air Force logistics command, his name now escapes me, basically said that we should be looking towards war with China in 2025. I think it's General Milliken or something of that sort. In any event, this this. I noticed that during the Trump administration, it was mainly trade and economic kind of conflict. But it was really under Biden that you had this escalation when it came to the military front. And of course, the Philippines was right there. And Biden brought the Japanese Prime Minister and Marcos Jr. together last April of last year and saying that the relationships among them were ironclad. Now, my big question is, how is Trump really going to relate to this? Will he continue this military containment of China, or will he arrive at some sort of deal with Xi Jinping? And of course, Kim Jong-un is just waiting to meet with him. And what sort of approach is he really going to articulate with respect to East Asia and the Pacific at this point in time? I think that he's quite unpredictable, but I would be very curious to see if he's going to continue the sort of Biden militarist approach, at least with respect to East Asia. So there's that. On the one hand, there's that situation with respect to the Trump transition. But I fully agree that the peace question is very central at this point, given the way that geopolitical rivalry has really escalated. How do global social movements, how should we be navigating this more complex world? One is, I fully agree that the peace question is something that we must embrace at this point in time, with all the sort of alliances that need to be made, the sort of concessions that we need to make, the sort of global coalitions that need to be formed at this point in time. But at the same time, I think that, and I think Adam has basically referred to this too, that even as we make that sort of a very important front, that we must also realize that with respect to the climate crisis and the other different crisis of equality, that those must also be addressed at this time. Let me just end by saying that, because there was a question that was posed regarding alliances within the South. There, one big thing, of course, that has emerged recently has been the BRICS. But the BRICS is mainly at this point largely potential rather than actual power, although for a lot of countries in the global South, both the more liberal democratic ones as well as the more authoritarian ones, I think there's been a beeline to the BRICS at this point, because these regimes may be in different, you know, have different regime complexes. But the one thing that they're both, they're all interested in is creating this formation that is a counterweight to the West and the multilateral order that was created by the West and which has been very oppressive. And I come back to what Adam has said, that when we were told that the Russian invasion of Ukraine was the thing that we should all be worried about in the global South, I think the response that we had from the global South was, hey, look, this is largely a European problem. There are much more important things going on, and you just can't expect that we will be harnessed into this Western alliance against Russia. And I think that's going to be more and more the response formations within the global South to move towards forming coalitions that do not get caught up in this tug of war between the West and, say, China and Russia. But at the same time, realizing that especially China does offer possibilities in terms of resources that can be used for development. So it's going to be a bit complex, but I think people realize that there are these spaces emerging even as things become more and more difficult. There are spaces that are emerging by which they could create more space for themselves in terms of pursuing their development agenda.
Thank you both. There is so much more we could say. There are questions I never got on to.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. Thank you for listening this far. This was a conversation between Nick Buxton, Adam Tews, and Walden Bellow as part of TNI's 2025 annual State of Power report on the geopolitics of capitalism. Please do visit our platforms to see more. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. You can find us on social media at TN Institute on Blue Sky, Ideas into Movement, as one word, on TikTok, and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you, and see you next time.